Now, before we engage in the activity of discussing Dharma, we need to consciously place our mind in a proper attitude. So, generally, the motivation, often we rely upon saying a prayer or some words, but the whole purpose is to try to consciously or actively place our mind firstly in the attitude of confidence in the Buddha and the Dharma and the Sangha, the three jewels, and secondly really have our mind in the attitude of I'm going to engage in this activity in order to train my mind on the path to enlightenment, in particular discussing how to practice bodhicitta so that I can repay the kindness of all beings. So those are the words, but the essence means to really have this attitude, and that it does take effort to stop thinking about everything else that's happening in our life and try to focus our attention on the reason we're here tonight and the ultimate purpose for all others. So it's really just having this warm heart and a very courageous heart, as we've been learning, how to not let any problem upset us. And in fact, to use whatever problems arise in our life in a constructive way, as we heard the many methods. So, as you are very well aware, I don't normally do the prayers, the traditional prayers, but we should. The important thing is the purpose of the prayers is to have this very sincere state of mind, thinking fundamentally of the welfare of others. That's why I'm here tonight. So try to generate your mind in that aspect as your motivation. Okay. Now, last week we began discussing the short text written by the Lama, whose name was Jigme Tenpa Nyima, who lived from 1865 to 1926 in his previous incarnation. And the text is titled, How to Transform or to Turn Suffering and Happiness into the Path to Enlightenment. And we discussed the first part of the text, which was how to utilize suffering as the path to enlightenment. And we mentioned there were two main ways or outlines for doing this. First is through thinking about the conventional truth or relative reality, cause and effect, etc. And the second, by thinking about ultimate reality of emptiness. And the first, the thinking about the relative reality of life in transforming problems into happiness or into the path, The first point there was to abandon, we have to abandon worry and concern, anxiety. Abandon the attitude of not wanting suffering. Seeing problems as bad. I remember once I was in America at our center in Boston, and some people, we went for a walk in the mountains. There was snow and it was very attractive. We were going up a narrow sort of ravine with a small watery creek with bits of ice, bits of snow going down. And it was quite difficult watching our footing. One of the people sort of pointed to a loose rock and she said, "Bad." Which, for an Australian, it was an unusual expression. We would have said, "Be careful," or "dangerous," but "bad." And I immediately thought of perhaps American children when they're growing up. I can imagine their parents, instead of saying, "Don't do that," they say, "Bad." So, and it's probably quite true, children do get this, and the bad is sets up a state of alarm or anxiety in their minds, and maybe they grow up thinking about that. So within that thought, you know, there are these things out there, these bad things which are going to harm me, and they're to be avoided at all costs. So whatever approach we have to problems, most of us have some way of bad, good, and worry. We do. We're concerned about what's going to happen, and me, my family, my friends, and so on. So the point is it's not that we shouldn't take care and avoid problems. Of course we should. But we shouldn't allow worry and concern to disturb our mind and to generate a state of anxiety and worry, because when we habitually allow our mind to see some situation or some person or something as bad, or you know, we don't like it, and if we let our mind think about it, it gets worse and worse and worse. Where, after a while, a small problem to our mind appears as a really big problem. And even any pain we experience is magnified by the degree of dislike or worry or concern about the object. And certainly we lose all our thought about practicing Dharma, training our mind, and we so easily fall into anger and aggression towards the things we don't like. So, problems, from our side, from our point of view, can be a big obstacle to the path. They are a big obstacle. They stop us from putting the effort into actively establishing our mind in virtue. Like, as I said, just so important at the beginning of any action to do so with a virtuous mind, with a virtuous intention. The intention is karma. And we are living within karmic causality. From the causal side, every purpose, every intention that we enter an action with will determine whether the action will be beneficial or non-beneficial from a karmic point of view. And, you know, we use the terms of virtue and non-virtue. And virtue encompasses morality and non-harmfulness, consideration for the welfare of others, and so on. So, in the beginning of practicing Dharma, we need to put effort into placing our mind in virtue and holding it. Problems, when problems occur, we throw it out the window. We can't do it. So, Tenpo Nyima, what we talked about last week. First he said, it's useless to regard suffering as purely bad and totally undesirable. Quoting Shantideva, he said, if the problem can be resolved, no point in worrying about it. If it can't be resolved, then worrying about it isn't going to help. And the second point he made was the great pain and stress involved in cultivating a habit of worry and anxiety about problems. So we then discussed the various methods that we can use to cultivate the attitude of being joyful when suffering arises, like having the opposite attitude, the opposite approach. And we can do that by seeing every situation in life as an aid to our practicing the path. And we mentioned a whole list of different methods when to deal with problems that occur in our life. First one was to train to use the problem to train our mind in renunciation, the thought of abandoning the belief that we grew up with, that life, the purpose of life is to enjoy pleasure and avoid pain. And the pleasure is out there. And to see the happy experiences, our senses, any, seeing, smelling, tasting, touching, and so on, and mental games, and, I guess computer, the joy of computer games is mental consciousness, there's nothing wrong. We see this, it is our right to have these, and these are good. And we, if we really check up, so much of our energy and our money and our time is spent in indulging in the pursuit of sensory or mental pleasure, which we say we see no problem with it. That's everybody else is doing it. I can get as much as I want, no problem. But that is the opposite of renunciation, as recognizing the folly of investing all of our hopes, all of our energy, just in this life. That nothing will last, and everything, and the experience of pleasure is what, in Buddhism we call changeable suffering, that it doesn't last, it fades away, and we want to have it again, never satisfied. So renunciation is that state of mind which has let go of the belief that I can be really happy today if I go to such and such a place, or if I meet such and such a friend, or if I eat this food, That is a mistaken belief. And spontaneously, effortlessly, always have the attitude of I'm going to achieve nirvana, I'm going to achieve liberation and enlightenment. These are the things that can be achieved, and this is the purpose of my life. As I mentioned on the weekend, that the thought of renunciation is not something that comes very quickly. It has to be based upon perfect concentration, and when renunciation is manifest, that thought to achieve nirvana, liberation and enlightenment is in our mind spontaneously and effortlessly 24 hours a day. So as soon as we wake up, normally we sort of think that there's something wrong with the alarm clock, it's much too early, we might, we want to stay in bed a bit longer, or what am I going to have for breakfast, or what do I have to do today? It's always the here and now that dominates our mind. So that means no renunciation. So when problems occur, yes, we avoid them, we try to avoid, but when they do occur, we tell our mind, there you go, mind, look, you thought you could get away with it, or you thought that you could not meet with such a problem. Here it is. And, you know, again, talking to our mind, since beginningless time, you've been experiencing these problems, and far worse. So, you will never achieve the perfect peace that you want, independence upon the outside world of contaminated things. Look towards you. The peace and happiness of nirvana and enlightenment, which don't have, will never let you down. Okay, so, training our mind in renunciation. Letting go our attachment to the belief that real happiness is out there waiting for me. Next, taking refuge. Realizing that the Buddha taught this reality of karmic, you know, the Four Noble Truths, the karma and afflictions are the cause of sufferings, and taught the reality of liberation and enlightenment. And so, when problems occur, we should strengthen our confidence in the Three Jewels. We can use the problem to practice patience. Most of us, if we have anger, we see that as a problem. Difficult to see attachment as a problem, but anger is definitely a problem in terms of causing suffering. By living in the belief that there are real self-existing enemies out there that I've got to avoid at all costs, that makes us very, very liable or very open to the danger of unhappiness, impatience, and anger. So, when problems happen, okay, the solution to anger is patience, the antidote. So when irritating things happen, instead of getting irritated, oh, fantastic, now I can really practice patience and deal with it. Then compassion. When we suffer, we can really have empathy, we can really understand the suffering of others. So in training in compassion, in remembering karma itself, in training our mind, in strong strong confidence in our teacher, our Dharma teacher, who has shown us the path. And that relationship between ourselves and our Dharma teacher is so vital. In any discipline, any art or any learning, field of learning, the more we trust and like and have confidence in our lecturer, our professor, our tutor, whoever is teaching us a particular skill, then the greater we will, the better student we will become, and the more quickly we will achieve those skills. But if we distrust the teacher, if we dislike and ignore and see them as bad, then we won't get, you know, we won't advance at all. So when problems occur, we think, this is exactly what I've been warned about, and now I really have to put into practice what the teacher has told me. Right, so these are various methods that we discussed last week about how to see difficulties and problems in a positive light, how to use them in training our mind. So we talked about that. And then Tenpo Nyima gave advice of how, you know, we should, it's not easy. We should begin the practice with small problems and learn how to put these methods into practice, and then gradually we will be able to deal with the bigger problems which are just around the corner waiting to happen. And we finished up last week with the point where he quoted the scriptures indicating that when we're not unhappy, when we're not agitated and full of anxiety or discontent about anything, then our mind is peaceful. Its natural peaceful state is manifest. And when our mind is peaceful, the physiological functioning of our body, you know, he talks about wind energy and so on, will be peaceful, will be in harmony. And when the body is in harmony, then the mind will be peaceful and undisturbed. So there's this wheel of happiness and peace revolves. We know that scientifically that anxiety and worry cause the release of various hormones in our body, and scientifically we say, oh, this is a good thing. This is the fight or flee reaction of distress, and the cortisone starts streaming through our body, our blood pressure goes up, our pulse rate increases, and there's all sorts of physiological changes with worry, with fear, anxiety, and neurological changes in the brain as well happen. And so if it's momentary, fine. Then we use this alert reaction to deal with problem. But most of us don't stop there. By maintaining the undercurrent of anxiety, which we really do, and we know how difficult it is when something really, pretty heavy has been happening in life, we can't concentrate, we can't even sleep, because we're worrying. Our mind is going over and over what to do and how to do it and so on. So there is physiology that is damaging the functioning of our body, the physiological balance in our body, and so physical illness as well can be a result of constant worry. In the next paragraph, he quotes a scripture where it says that, like vultures or birds of prey find horses and donkeys who have sores on their backs easy prey. So, a horse or a donkey has a wound on their back, and the bird of prey comes and attacks. The horse or donkey can't do anything about it. So they're easy. So in the same way, harmful spirits easily find a chance to harm people who are always prone to fear. But they find it very difficult to harm those whose temperament is confident and stable. So whether we're talking about external spirits, and of course in Buddhism there are malevolent beings external to us who can cause harm. There are also the internal spirits of our other disturbing emotions. So if our mind is weak with fear and anxiety, then we can be harmed either by external spirits or internal. If we're strong and confident, they can't hurt you. And I've heard, I don't know whether this is folklore or what, bees, that dogs for sure, I've seen this, if you have fear, a dog somehow picks that vibration up as hostility. Because fear is a type of aggression, isn't it? Fear is, I don't like that, get away from me. You know, it is a psychological attitude of aggression. And a dog is more likely to attack somebody who is afraid of it than somebody who is totally unafraid. And I've heard that the same with bees. They will attack and sting those who are afraid, but not those who are not afraid. I'm not interested in experimenting to see whether it's true or not. Let somebody else do that. So, to continue now, what Tenpo Nyima has to say, he says, therefore, learned ones see that any happiness or suffering depends entirely upon the mind. And so they seek peace and happiness from within the mind itself. I mean, it's so simple, but it's so profound also, that most of our life we're really trying to find peace and happiness, convinced it's out there. But the source, the underlying source, is the mind itself. So look into the mind. It says, for all the causes of happiness are already there, complete within us, and they do not depend upon anything outside. There is nothing or no one that can be hurt by any harm from sentient beings or anything else. And the same holds true at the time of death as well. You will always be free. With this understanding of our own minds and the knowledge of how to maintain our mind in peace and happiness, no matter what is happening out there, we can't be harmed. We're not talking about emptiness here. It's like if our mind is not agitated, not upset, then whatever words people, you know, criticize us, abuse us, tell lies about us, etc. If the mind's peaceful, those words just go straight through. You know? There's nothing in here for those words, which are like arrows, to hit. But if we have the tight knot of self-consciousness and worry about my image, my reputation, me, then whatever the harm, whether it's words or, you know, actual physical harm, then there can be great. Those words have something to hit and cause problems. Well, what the children in the schoolyard chant, sticks and stones can break my bones, but names can never hurt me. Yeah, but you try and insult a kid in the schoolyard and names initiate a very angry response. But it's true, names, words, harsh words, abuse, can never actually hurt me if we're at peace. So, I mean, this is the simple reality that Tenpo Nyima is trying to get across to us. This is a profound Buddhist teaching. Names can never hurt me. How? So he says, and even if when death comes, the mind is at peace, we deal with death totally, easily, without being upset. It's all up to us. And death is coming. So, if we have this method, and if we train in this method of transforming problems into happiness, or seeing the usefulness of problems, he says, you will always be free. And he says the samadhi, the concentration of bodhisattvas called pervading all phenomena with happiness, is attained in just this way. So, can you imagine? If you were able to have mindfulness, the often we use the term mindfulness for concentration. So if you're really acutely aware and mindful that whatever happens, good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, can be utilized in the path, can be made useful in my Dharma practice. Therefore, we have this subjective outgoing attitude towards our friends, towards society, towards the world, that we only see good things coming. There's no anxiety. I haven't had any teaching on how to develop the samadhi of pervading all phenomena with happiness. But just its name sounds so nice. And you see it in beings like His Holiness Dalai Lama, you know, our teachers, Lama Tumzob Rinpoche, the realized lamas. They don't get upset. No matter what happens, their mind is cheerful, laughing, and they deal with problems, and they see so many problems, and they always react in a calm, skillful, constructive way with joy. Of course, they do deal with problems. They must deal with problems. But by having this attitude, they do so skillfully, and they don't make it worse with misery. So that's what learned ones do. Now Tenpo Nyingma says, foolish ones, they chase after external objects in which they hope to find happiness. But whatever happiness they do achieve, great or small, it always turns out like the saying, it isn't you that's in control. Your hair is caught up in a tree. You know, you imagine someone with long hair and it's caught up in the branch of a tree and the wind is blowing, so wherever the branch goes, you have to go, right? But you're controlled by your hair caught up in this moving tree branch. So similarly, when we find objects of pleasure and happiness, we become entrapped. And we are forced to go in life wherever the object of our pleasure goes. We have to go along, whether it's another person or even a possession. The possession starts to rule us. We're worried. There's so many people, very wealthy, they buy famous paintings, but the painting's so valuable that they have to have a copy painted and the original put in a bank vault under the ground. So, because it might be stolen or destroyed. Or, you know, my beautiful new car. It might rain, I'm not driving in it today. Or dust. Look, there's dust. Or a tiny little scratch on my car. You know, the possession takes control of us. We're not free anymore. We become the slaves of the people, the possessions, the jobs even, the social status which we have grasped at for happiness. We've lost our freedom. Whereas the wise ones are totally free. No matter what happens in life, they are in control. So, continuing about the foolish ones, they experience nothing but one failure after another. Things don't work out as we hoped they would, not completely. We can't finish anything. We make misjudgments. And enemies and thieves have no problem in causing us harm. And even the slightest criticism will separate us from our happiness. That's when we invest all our hopes out there. He says, however much a crow looks after a baby cuckoo, it can never turn it into a baby crow. So, you know, the cuckoo lays the egg in the crow's nest, and a baby cuckoo hatches, and the crows look after it, but it doesn't grow into a crow, it grows into a cuckoo. Similarly, however much we invest into pleasure in this life, into the games we play, into the friends we make, into the, you know, the situations, the holidays, and ever, forever, the objects or the sources of pleasure will never become pure as we imagine to be. They won't turn out to be what we hoped they would be. There are so, you know, all of these things are abandoned, left behind, and you have to go on. I don't know if they show on the television here in America, you know, that they have big, not factories, but big buildings with many rooms, lock-up rooms, where people can just lock up their goods, which they can't fit in the house anymore. So they lock up things. And then often these rooms get abandoned. And so after so many years, the owner can't be found, so they auction the room. And do they have those shows here? Yeah. So the people come along and they pay money, and some of them get incredible treasures. But all of these, like treasures, in as much, real sources of happiness. But somebody else thought that. But they were left behind, they were locked up, and even the ones who discover the new treasure, eventually, they're going to put it into a similar room and die. So, the point is that the apparent sources of happiness in the outside world that we believe will make us so happy are not what we believe them to be. And they're going to let us down. Like the baby cuckoo will never become a crow. So he says, so therefore your mind becomes just unreliable and out of tune. You know, it's out of tune with reality because we're living in our projected reality, which is wrong. It's out of tune. Then there is nothing that is not tiresome for the gods, a source of misery for negative spirits, or suffering for oneself. So even the gods, you know, the devas, the desire realm devas, who have so much pleasure, even their pleasures, which are beyond what we humans could imagine, become tiresome, become, you know, boring. And for hungry ghosts, they see, like, food or drink, and hard to get. Finally, after so much crying, they get it, but the food can't be swallowed because they have small necks, or the water becomes like acid and burns them inside. And so, for humans, also, the objects of pleasure become objects of suffering. They become burdens. They become our jailers. They wear out. We lose them, and we pine for them, and so on. So, think about that. About being in tune. I like that term, being in tune with reality. We are out of tune with reality. This, he says, this heart advice brings together in a nutshell 100 different and essential points. There are many other ways of accepting suffering and hardships in practicing the path, and many other secret instructions for using illness and harmful influences as the path. But here, I'm just giving a general outline, which is easy to understand, of how to accept suffering based on the teachings of the noble Shantideva and his wise followers. So if you want to further explore this method, Shantideva's Bodhisattva's Way of Life is the one to read. So the next outline, how to use suffering as the path by means of ultimate truth, ultimate reality of emptiness. He says, you've had so many instructions on emptiness, the ultimate nature of things, how nothing exists in its own right or independent of causes and conditions, independent of the label, and yet we all have the mistaken delusion that I and others and the objects do exist inherently. So he says, by reflecting upon the teachings we've heard on emptiness, we can see that there's no such thing as an inherently existing negative circumstance, and there's no inherently existing suffering. So that is, particularly one of our biggest problems is maybe somebody in our family, mother, father, husband, wife, child, and we can't get on, friends who suddenly become enemies, and we just can't get on with them. If we can reflect upon our relationship problem with somebody in the light of ultimate reality, that the person we can't get on with does not exist inherently in his or her own right as I'm seeing them. They're empty of existing according to my projection. And so am I. I am also empty of existing as an inherently findable individual as I think I exist. Empty of it. There is a body and mind. Here, suitable to be called me, a body and mind, simple to be called him or her. So, understanding, seeing each other in the light of emptiness, of inherent existence, diffuses so much of the tension that we build up in relationship problems. And we can see the folly. Usually relationship problems come when the other person does something small which we find irritating. A small irritation. But then we focus upon that and we start to look for it. And it becomes something bigger, something worse, something inherently them. It may be just the way they cough, some ridiculously small thing. But our mind magnifies it as part of them. And so we reject the whole person because of some small thing that they do that causes some minor irritation. Our mind won't let it go. Our mind plays with it, builds it up and up and up. And they're doing the same thing to us. There is something about us which they're not too happy with, but we unknowingly, we repeat it, we might repeatedly do it, and so in their mind they see it as an inherently existing negative part of me. So they distance themselves from us. Really, I think so many of our problems, and most of our problems in life, the big ones are relationship problems with parents, with our spouse, with our children, with our friends, and can be so easily prevented by thinking of ultimate reality of emptiness, that the body and mind, that they're products of karma and afflictions. Of course they're not perfect. Who am I to demand that they are perfect, to demand that they live according to the way I think they should live, the way they should cough or eat their food, the way I think they should. And who am I? You know, this, my body, my mind are also the products of karma and afflictions. They're true sufferings. And they're empty of existing inherently. And so, by reflecting upon the ultimate reality of emptiness, then our mind can be peaceful, as Tenpo Nyima, as he says. Bringing your mind into the supreme peace of emptiness, the as-it-is natural state of mind, remain there. And in that state, not even the name negative circumstance, you know, problem, not even the name problem or the name suffering can be found. So he's emphasizing now, meditate on emptiness of self by allowing your mind to abide in that awareness that we're empty of inherent existence. And so, in that state, even the word problem, even the word suffering can't be found. He says, when you come out of this state, then, and you're faced with your mother or your father or your spouse, then the way in which the problem arose in your mind will not be the same as before. When fear and apprehension and dislike appeared in your mind, meditating on emptiness is incredibly powerful in diffusing the tension of anxiety. And so you can overcome these problems or sufferings by regarding them as hollow, just like mere words. And he says, there's no need for me to say anything else. You get the message. He didn't say that, but that's what he implied. Okay. So his next point is the second major part of this text, is how to use happiness in the path as the path to enlightenment. So first of all, through the relative truth, and secondly, through ultimate truth. So he says, whenever happiness or things that cause happiness come, if you slide under their control, you know, like your hair being caught up in the tree, then qualities like supercilious arrogance, complacent conceit, and laziness will grow. And these will block off your path to spiritual development. It is difficult not to slip under their control. As it is said, people can cope with a lot of suffering, but only a little happiness. Right? People can deal with suffering and pain strongly, but we give up. When the pleasure happens, we just totally give in and allow the pleasure to take control. The object of pleasure, the situation, experiencing pleasure, and the pleasure itself to dominate our mind. This is what I want, and we let everything else go. We give ourselves up. For this reason, he says, consider from many different angles how all things that exist are impermanent, right? Changing, never lasting exactly the same for more than a brief moment, and by nature full of suffering, as we discuss in the weekend in the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. He says, so this this alertness, this mindfulness, is when we're experiencing pleasure. It doesn't mean be afraid of pleasure. It doesn't mean run away from pleasure. It means be careful. Don't get sucked in. Don't get trapped. Don't see it as more than what it actually is. He says, develop a deep sense of disillusionment with samsara and make an effort to stop the mind drifting into mindless carelessness. Now, that's the danger. We become careless. Which means we allow attachments, we allow pride, we allow desire, all of the afflictive emotions, greed, miserliness, to arise. Reflect on how all the happiness or material wealth that this world can offer is trifling and insignificant and bound up with all kinds of difficulties. Reflect upon that. What we need to do to get the person, the wealth, the situation that we feel is going to give me stable happiness. Even though some of it has a good side, right? So he quotes the Buddha. Buddha said, it's very hard for a person whose freedom is impaired by suffering to attain enlightenment. For a person who's happy, it's very easy. Right? If you're hungry, you can't study or meditate. If you don't have somewhere to live, no, protect you from the weather, you can't study and meditate. It's very difficult to train the mind. So, but if you do have a full stomach, if you're comfortable, you're healthy, you have somewhere to go home to, then it's easy to study and meditate, train your mind in the path. So, Tenpo Nyingma says you should be aware that your being able to practice the Dharma in a state of happiness is a great good fortune and merit. This is something that comes from previous merit, from previous karma. Now, in every possible way, you should convert this happiness, this pleasure, into Dharma. Right? So, every happiness is a result of virtue, but instead of letting the happy situation seduce you away from practicing Dharma, you turn the happy situation into Dharma. Also, you go to a beautiful place, lots of nice scenes, water, mountains, flowers, birds, animals. Then you offer it. You enjoy it, but as you enjoy it, how wonderful if everybody else could enjoy this peace of this countryside that I'm enjoying. How wonderful it would be if they could, think of people who are locked up in jail or in hospital and so on, who just probably never have the opportunity to experience the pleasure you're having. So, think, just experience it with the sense that you are the envoy, or you are the leader experiencing this for everybody, and really offering to your lamas, offering to the Buddhas, of the physical things you're experiencing as well as visualized offerings. There are so many ways we can accumulate positive merit, through mental practice. And formally, we have all these practices, the Guru Puja, etc., that we do, and the tantric meditations. So much is involved making offerings. People do the Vajrayogini practice every month. Probably, even my sati, so many offerings. It's going for pages and pages. But if it's done with visualization, with a good heart, and thinking of what Vashikini represents, you know, female Buddha, unbelievable merit. So you can only do that if your mind is happy. So Tenpo Nyingma says, also, as peace and happiness arise continuously from the Dharma, then you should train yourself to let the Dharma and happiness help each other. I said last week that I've told people in Australia, if you're not happy, you're not practicing Dharma. Because the meaning of practicing Dharma is to make the mind happy. Virtue. Practicing Dharma is establishing the mind in virtue. Virtue. Non-anger, non-attachment, non-ignorance, loving-kindness, generosity, patience. These mental attitudes are virtue, and by nature they're pleasant. When the mind is in the aspect of compassion, love, and kindness, the mind's happy. So you see, the afflictions, the disturbing emotions, by nature, anger, pride, attachment, jealousy, spitefulness, they make the mind unhappy. These are the root causes of happiness and unhappiness. So, if we're unhappy, non-virtue is manifesting in our mind. We're not practicing Dharma. If we're happy, we're practicing Dharma. So, if we use happy, pleasant situations, pleasure and joy in life, to enhance virtue, then happiness increases our Dharma practice, and Dharma practice increases our happiness. It's just the opposite circle of suffering and misery. So obvious, isn't it? We've got to be aware and do it. We've got to be mindful throughout the day. That's the next next topic. Okay. If you don't train yourself in the circle of practicing Dharma, using happiness to practice Dharma and experiencing happiness from Dharma practice, he said it would be rather like trying to boil water in a wooden pot. You'll end up where you started. You know, if we try to boil water, put fire under a wooden pot, no chance. If we don't use happiness to enhance our Dharma practice, then we're going to run out. So he said, you must get the essence of this teaching through applying whatever peace or happiness that you enjoy to your Dharma practice. This is what Nagarjuna taught in the jewel garland, or the rosary of jewel, the Ratna Valley. Is even when you're happy, if you don't realize it, then it will never become anything you can use for practicing Dharma. So as a remedy against spending your whole life hoping for some extra, further happiness with lots of projects, lots of activities in our life, you should maintain the nectar of contentment with whatever you already have, and along with that, put this teaching into practice. So be content. Maintain the nectar of contentment in what you have. Don't disturb your life with all these activities and projects. Oh, I must do this, must do that, must do that. Use what you've got and use whatever current peace you have as a turn that energy into Dharma practice. He says there are other ways of using happiness as the path, based on recalling the kindness of the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, and on the instructions for training in bodhicitta, but this will do for now. As with using suffering in the path, with happiness too, you need to go to a solitary retreat environment and do the practices of purification and accumulating merit and wisdom, one after the other. So that's transforming happiness into the path, according to the conventional truth, and now transforming happiness into the path by means of the ultimate truth. He says it's the same as in the case of using suffering as the path. By meditating on emptiness, yourself, and entering that stillness, that peace, even we haven't realized emptiness, to its full degree, just thinking, just hearing the term shunyata, or emptiness, can be incredibly beneficial in making the mind peaceful, more open. So go into that meditative state, meditate on it, and then when you come out of empty, that meditation, then you're experiencing happiness, but you don't grasp at the object as inherently existing. You don't grasp at the happiness as something inherently existing. You're much more open. You see your pleasurable home, your pleasurable circle of friends, for what they are, empty of inherent existence. You don't abandon them, you don't negate them, you simply enjoy them without falling into the trap of clinging, seeing them as inherent existing and not wanting to separate from them. So you get more happy. Okay. So he says, if you cannot practice when you are suffering because of what it does to your mind, and if you cannot practice when you're happy because of attachment to your happiness, then there will never be a time when you can practice at all. So for the Dharma practitioner, there's nothing more crucial or useful than this advice. And if you do have this practice, wherever you live, in a solitary place or in the city, whatever company you're in, good or bad, whatever comes, riches or poverty, happiness or sorrow, whatever you hear, praise or criticism, good talk or bad, you'll never have any fear that it can hurt you. This is called the lion-like yoga. The lion is the king of animals, not afraid of any other animal in the forest. Whatever you do, your mind will be happy, open, spacious, and relaxed. Your character will be pure, and eventually you will attain realizations. Even if physically you're living in an impure land, your mind will enjoy the splendor of inconceivable happiness and bliss. Just like the bodhisattvas in the pure lands. It's just as the precious Kadampa lamas used to say, with happiness under control and suffering brought to an end, when you're all alone, this will be your companion. When you are ill, it will be your nurse. So this will be your companion in sorrow. When you are ill, it will be your nurse. It says, goldsmiths, who jewelers, working with gold, they remove the impurities from the gold by melting it, make it very flexible, rinsing it again and again. So he says it's just the same with the mind. Our mind is impure, it is inflexible, but if by using happiness as the path you make your mind clear and pure, then you will easily attain the extraordinary samadhi which makes the mind and body capable of doing whatever you wish. So these are the meditative achievements. They you know, when you are able to achieve, you know, calm abiding, it's explained in the text how you experience mental and physical bliss. And you feel that you can do, you can fly, you can do anything. And it's a lack of peace which prevents us achieving calm abiding. See, a lot of people think that, oh, if I do a calm abiding retreat, I can become so peaceful. No. You need to be peaceful before you can achieve calm abiding through this practice. Because when you're in retreat, your mind just, oh, it just goes out of control. And you start thinking about your whole life, it comes up, and oh, if only I'd done this instead of that. And you get caught up in history. You get caught up in small things happening here and now. And no way can you have achieved calm abiding. So peace and stillness of the mind precedes the attainment of calm abiding. Sure, the attainment of calm abiding is incredibly blissful, etc. But it's not going to be the source of your peaceful mind now. He says, I feel that this practice alone is the most profound and important for perfecting morality and ethics, which is the source of everything positive and wholesome. This is because not being attached to happiness creates the foundation of the special discipline of renunciation. And not being afraid of suffering makes this discipline totally pure. Right? Morality is the foundation of all Dharma practice. Morality, pure morality, is a foundation of concentration. So he's just, actually, I made the point before my comment, but this is the point that he's making, that the peace has to come first before the concentration, and the concentration has to precede the wisdom, seeing reality. So he says, they say that generosity is the basis of morality, and patience is a purifier of morality. Through training in this practice now, then when you attain the higher paths, it will be like what is said, he quotes a scripture here, you will realize that all phenomena are like an illusion, and that all these, or all your births, are like walking into a park, whether in good times or bad, prosperity or ruin, there will be no fear of negative emotions or suffering. Here's some illustrations from the life of Buddha. Before he attained enlightenment, he renounced the position of universal ruler, you know, Dharma Chakra king, as if it were straw. And he lived by the river Naranjana without a care for the harshness of the austerities he was practicing. This shows that one must have equal taste between happiness and suffering. We shouldn't distinguish happiness good, suffering bad, equal. We need that in order to realize the nature of enlightenment and to benefit ourselves. Then, after Buddha attained enlightenment, the chiefs of the men and gods as far as the highest realms placed his feet on the crown of their heads and offered him respect, service, and everything he needed. However, the Brahmin Bhadraja abused him and criticized him 100 times. A Brahmin's daughter accused him of sexual misconduct. He lived off rotten horse fodder for 3 months in the land of King Agridatta, and so on. But in all of these situations, being worshipped and been given everything, another half of it, he remained without the slightest fluctuation in his mind, high or low, just as Mount Meru remains unshaken by the wind. This shows how you must have that equal taste again in order to act for the benefit of sentient beings. So that's his final advice. Equal taste. Suffering, happiness, equal. Don't discriminate. Good, bad. Use it. Use it in your Dharma practice. Then the colophon says this kind of teaching should really be taught by the Kadampas, the Jo'o Kadampas, who in their lifestyles embodied their saying, never complaining when there is suffering and having great renunciation when there's happiness. But if it is explained by someone like me, I feel sure that even my own tongue is going to get embarrassed and fed up with it. And yet, with the aim of making myself making a habit of equal taste, whether I face happiness or sadness, praise or blame, gain or loss, fame or insignificance, I, the old beggar, Temple Nyima, have written this in the forest of many birds. So he sums it up by mentioning the eight worldly dharmas. Seeing them with equal taste. This is an incredible approach. We have so many teachings about the eight worldly dharmas, but not reacting to them with anger or attachment. How to do it, seeing them equally, and to use them, to use these situations in the path, is really something new. Well, I guess it's implied in the Lamrim, but this is how the Bodhisattva deals with those problems. So that was the transforming problems into the path. It was the third point in the 7-point mind training. We only have time to discuss the next one, but it is the essence anyway. The next point is to how to practice in our daily life the 5 points for daily practice, the 5 powers for cultivating and enhancing bodhicitta, right? So the subject of these words in his talks is how to cultivate and practice bodhicitta. So his 5 ways how to do it in daily life. So the first power is called the power of determination or planning. So this we invoke every morning when we wake up, even before we get out of bed, we should invoke the power of determination by thinking, I shall not waste my day following self-cherishing. I will practice the 2 bodhicittas, right? Conventional bodhicitta, universal responsibility, ultimate bodhicitta, wisdom realizing emptiness. So that's the first thing we should think about as we wake up. The determination that today I'm going to do it. This is the most important of the 5 powers, because it's the others follow upon this. The motivation, it determines the karmic outcome of all the actions that we're going to do today. As we said at the beginning of tonight, the motivation determines the outcome. If we motivate our day with bodhicitta and emptiness, it's just a few seconds thinking of it, but generating it. Unbelievable, the whole day. If we keep that alive, that's the other powers. Even a mundane day, going to work, doing this, doing your job, you think, oh, I wish I could be practicing Dharma. Hey, you're not practicing Dharma because you don't know how to practice Dharma. So, thinking from now on, especially today, I shall exchange self and others, you know, through the giving and taking, and never separate my mind from the subjective and objective aspects of bodhicitta. Subjective, conventional bodhicitta, the great compassion, universal compassion, the intention to achieve enlightenment, Buddhahood. The objective is the objects of our great compassion. Every sentient being that I meet today, everyone without exception, is the object of my great compassion. Remember that. Otherwise, we ignore. You know, we see sentient beings, but we don't see them in the light of bodhicitta. Wasted opportunity. And emptiness too. Subjective, empty of inherent existence. Object, those sentient beings are empty of inherent existence. Empty. So that is the power of determination. Just to generate that thought, and it only takes a few minutes, even half a minute, you can do it. Then you get out of bed. Okay, you wash your face. And the next is called the power of the white, literally white seed, referring to the root of virtue. Now the root of virtue is our accumulation of positive karma, you know, the merit that we generate. And it's like, it's all that's positive, you know. The definition of virtue, you know, is positive action. When we do good things, we feel encouraged, we are strengthened, we have self-confidence, our self-esteem is stronger, our capacity to achieve, you know, virtuous goals becomes so much greater. This is the cumulative power, which is called the white seed. White, virtue. Black, non-virtue. So, to increase our strength, our personal capacity, then we should do some meditation, right, or whatever we're capable of doing, like even simply going through the step, you know, prostration, making offerings, confessing, confessing negative karmas, and rejoicing in the virtuous karmas of others, and requesting the Buddhas to remain, and dedicating, then, you know, the basic sevenfold prayer to accumulate merit and to purify the opposites, you know, purify greed and anger, etc. So we may have a small altar or even a visualized Buddha in our room to do prostrations, and whatever time we have, do some preliminary practices, reflect on the six perfections. So some virtuous action, not just when we get out of bed. It could only be 5 or 10, but to bring it to mind, and then throughout the day, be mindful of opportunities to train your mind in generosity, in patience, in ethics, in enthusiastic perseverance, in concentration and wisdom. Like everything, going on the train to work or driving to work, driving, such an opportunity to practice patience. Actually, in Singapore, the drivers are very courteous. They're pretty good. You should try driving in Sydney, I tell you. I mean, you know, in Australia, in America too, road rage is so common. And so many people get so angry that they will smash their car into yours, and they'll pull out a gun, and they'll kill people, they'll run over. Look, it's happening on a daily occasion in each major city in Australia. Terrible anger. So, what a waste. What a waste of a good opportunity to practice Dharma. Somebody goes slow, makes you 3 or 4 seconds late. Thank you. And also offering them, please, go ahead, you know. So, this is the power of the white seed, right? Throughout the day, an opportunity to practice Dharma. So many. That's the second power. The third power is called the power of familiarity. So, formally, you know, and repetitively throughout the day, we should bring to mind again emptying some bodhicitta. You know, what's Om Mani Padme Hum? You know, Om is the body, speech, and mind of enlightenment, of Buddhahood. And Mani is the jewel. You know, the jewel of great compassion. Padme, the lotus of wisdom. Hung, the unification of method and wisdom. Unification of compassion and wisdom. Om Mani Padme Hum. So the power of method. That's why a rosary is carried, to remind oneself. You don't need to have a mala if you're a Buddhist. It's just an aid to remember it. And Om Mani Padme Hum. What an incredible mantra, what it is. It is the condensation of the entire path to enlightenment, wisdom and compassion. So, power of familiarity is to reflect upon emptiness of bodhicitta throughout the day, and the method of practicing bodhicitta. The fourth power is called the power of abandonment. And during the day, the power of abandonment is to abandon non-virtue. When we see that we could be getting a little bit attached, a little bit of desire, or just a little fantasy, you know, oh, that'd be nice, you know, something in the shop window, or another person, oh, quite nice. Abandon that desire. Abandon that anger or jealousy. And then, at the end of the day, reflect. Reflect back upon how you went. How did you go during the day? In the morning when you woke up, you generated the power of determination. Today, I'm going to focus my entire mind on emptiness, the ultimate bodhicitta, and conventional bodhicitta, universal compassion, universal responsibility. So we think about what you did, where you, you know, there's the famous Kadampa Lama who had a bag of black and white stones. Every time he did a negative action, he put a black stone here, a good action, a white stone here. At the end of the day, he empties pockets, and if the pile of white stones was bigger than the pile of black stones, he'd congratulate himself, good Geshe. If the pile of black stones was bigger, he'd scold himself. So maybe it's a good idea to carry around a bag of black and white stones and have two pockets. So abandonment also, at the end of the day, spend some time to purify the times when you blew it. And we do. Look, we get attached, we get jealous, we get angry so quickly. Don't think you're bad. Purify. We've been taught so many methods, prostration of the 35 Buddhas, Vajrasattva mantra and so on. There are many methods where you think of the specific thing where you create a non-virtue and you purify it. And in the process, like the four opponent powers, the fourth power is to say, tomorrow I'll do better. Tomorrow I will not repeat that action. Just tomorrow. You don't say forever and ever. Just tomorrow, I'm not going to do it. It said, at every opportunity, destroy self-cherishing as it manifests, just as you would chase away a thieving dog. And finally, the fifth prayer, the fifth power is a power of prayer. So, you go back to your bed, and before you go to sleep, then you think of virtue, you rejoice at the virtues you've created during the day, and you rejoice at the virtues of others. Now, this is the easiest way to create virtue, So all the good things others are doing throughout the world, throughout the universe, and rejoice sincerely, and then you share the merit. So the power of prayer. And you can do what you can. Again, you can bring your mind back to emptiness and bodhicitta. Om mani padme hum. Compassion and wisdom. These are the two. And you go to sleep. So these are the five powers. The first, determination. Then white sage, which means enhancing the root of virtue. Familiarity, like having a mala, remembering wisdom and compassion throughout the day. Power of abandonment, not practicing non-virtue, avoiding non-virtue. And finally, the power of prayer at night. So that is how to develop and how to train your mind in bodhicitta each day, and is clearly, how do you say? And there are others too. We've only got up three or four of the 7 points, but the others are more advice on how to practice. So you can see in the Lamrim texts, there's the 18 commitments, the 22 instructions on mind training, and so on. So you could look those up. So that brings us to an end of the teaching on how to cultivate and practice bodhicitta. Once again, I thank you for making this possible. It's a great honour to be here in Singapore and to meet you all. I feel great admiration for the way you do practice Dharma, and I feel a bit like Tepo Nyima. My tongue should be embarrassed by talking about bodhicitta, because I think you are practicing more than me. I know you are. I mean, the whole, this building, everything that's happened here is so wonderful, so something to rejoice. But of course, a Dharma center is a place to practice in. So we need to continually practice, train our minds in the wisdoms of listening, thinking, and meditating, and use the Dharma center. I mean, if we do what we've talked about tonight, all of Singapore becomes Amitabha Buddha Center. Right? There is no building, no place which is not ABC. And in your heart, be aware of that. And of course, whenever we come to a holy place like this, we usually check up. You know, we don't do something lazy or silly. So the same, every street, every road, every place is ABC, and a fantastic opportunity to practice Dharma, whether things go well or they don't go well, doesn't matter. They can equally be incorporated into the path. So let's again complete this series of talks and tonight's talk by dedicating the positive energy, the root of virtue that we have collectively accumulated tonight. May this remain strong and never be lost from my mind until I achieve my full potential of Buddhahood and are able to lead all mother sentient beings out of suffering. Thank you so much.